This is Richard Barone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. David Harp. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, in the Special Collections Library interview room. Mr. Harp, you're in Ashburn, Georgia, is that correct?
That's correct.
Great. Sir, if we could, let's start with some basic biographical information. When and where were you born?
I was born in Ashburn, Georgia, December the 31st, 1928.
Okay. Did you grow up in Ashburn?
Yes. In fact, I'm living in the same house I was born in.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's something. So you've basically come full circle and come back home.
Right.
To where you are.
Yeah, I left here in, '46 when I graduated from Ashburn High School. Mm-hmm. Went off to college, and I was down at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College, mm-hmm. and they were about to draft me for the Korean War.
Korea, okay.
And I didn't want any part of the walking army, so I immediately went and joined the Air Force.
Okay. Before we get to that point, can you describe your childhood? How would you describe your childhood to me?
Well, more or less normal. Mm-hmm. My father, he traveled a lot, mm-hmm. and he did own some farms scattered around South Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Was he a farmer?
Well, per se.
Okay.
We had, back in those days, we had sharecroppers.
Okay.
And although we lived in town, mm-hmm. but we did on one farm, which was only 2 miles from town. Mm-hmm. We operated it ourselves and okay. raised cattle and hogs, and mm-hmm. peanuts and cotton. Mm-hmm. But I never did work too much on the farm. Back in the 30s, I guess, mm-hmm. mother and father opened up a grocery store in town.
Okay. In Ashburn?
In Ashburn, yeah. Okay. Of course, my mother operated that most of the time because of my father traveling so much. He worked for the North American Land Company. And
did you work in the store?
Well, I was a little too young right then.
Okay.
And after school, I'd just come home and mm-hmm. mess around like any kid would. mm-hmm. But then later, as I got a little larger and all, I used to have to run the tractor out at the farm quite a bit. That was about the extent.
Would you do that after school?
Yeah.
Okay.
During the summer.
Okay. So how long did your family keep the grocery store going?
They sold that out. Let's see. It must have been in the latter 40s, I guess, mm-hmm. or mid-40s.
How was it growing up during the Depression?
Well, there wasn't much money. Mm-hmm. Although we did manage, we had, you might say, plenty of food because of the farm and all. Mm-hmm. And in fact, after I retired, came back, I was up at the car dealership one day, and this elderly black man came up and said, "Aren't you David Harp?" I said, "Yes." Well, he used to work for my father on the farm.
Okay.
And he was saying, well, said, "We sure didn't have much money, but we always had plenty to eat."
I guess that's an advantage of working on the farm.
Right.
What are your most vivid memories of the Depression?
Not too much. Mm-hmm. I really don't recall. You know, I know a lot of people had terrible times, mm-hmm. But like I said, we were fortunate that we, you know, had land that we could grow food on and raise our own meat, process our own syrup, and meats, and everything that we needed.
Right. Okay. And so in Ashburn there, you attended elementary school and middle school and
high school.
And high school.
Yes.
Okay. What do you remember about your high school years?
To tell you the truth, not an awful lot.
It wasn't very memorable.
At that time, you know, it was a small school. I think in my class, we only had about, I think it was around 28 or 30 in my class. Mm-hmm. And, of course, after school, you know, everybody went on to their own homes.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, we walked to school. They didn't
right.
have buses and all like they do today.
Right, right. How far did you have to walk to school?
It was about a mile, maybe a mile and a quarter.
Okay. Okay. What were your favorite subjects in high school?
My favorites were geography and history. And I detested math and English.
Did you play any sports?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Why not?
I just didn't seem to have an interest in it.
Okay.
And of course, I didn't push sports like, well, I mean, we played ball and stuff like that, but it wasn't organized like it is today.
Okay.
Where you have intramural sports.
Right.
Everything.
Right. Did your parents emphasize education to you, how important it was?
Yes. Of course, a lot of it I had to dig out on my own because, well, you know, like I had told you, my father traveled so much, and then my mother was working, keeping the store. And so I wasn't... what you'd call an A student, because
okay.
I didn't apply myself like I should have.
Right.
But I finally made it.
Okay. Did you have any siblings?
Well, I got a late start in life. And oh, you wait a minute, brothers and sisters.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I had two half sisters. And one half brother,
okay.
One whole brother, and one sister that she passed away when she was only two, just before I was born.
Okay.
My father's first wife had died in the flu epidemic back when was that 1918,
yes,
I believe, sometime
yes,
along in there, and later he met my mother in Atlanta. They got married.
Okay. Whereabouts is Ashburn? Is it close to Atlanta?
No, we're about 180 miles south of Atlanta. It's right on Interstate 75 going south.
Okay.
We're about 82 miles north of the Florida line.
Okay. All right. So you graduated from high school in 1946.
Yes.
And you went to college.
Right.
Now, why did you choose to go to college then? Was it expected of you, or did you really...
Yes, it was expected.
Okay, all right.
I had wanted to go to Canada and join the Royal Canadian Air Force. They would take you younger than our forces would, but my parents wouldn't go along. My oldest brother, he was in the Canadian Air Force.
Oh, really?
Okay. And after we... got into war, then he was transferred back into the American Air Force. But now let's see, where was lost my train of thought.
Well, let me ask you this: where did you get the desire to fly and to join the Air Force?
I guess, well, as a child, they used to have these little barnstorming pilots that occasionally would come through the town.
Yes, sir.
Take people up for a ride for a dollar, I was just, I forget how old I was when I took my first airplane ride, but I was real, real young.
Mm-hmm.
And I just fell in love with it then.
Okay.
And every chance that I could get a ride like that, I'd take it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess because my oldest brother was a pilot, that probably influenced me. And the fact that I did not want to be in the walking army.
Right, right. Did you have any military tradition in your family besides your brother?
Well, my whole brother, he was in the Navy.
Okay.
He and my oldest brother, they both went in before we were in war.
Okay.
And my youngest brother, he went and joined the U.S. Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And then my oldest brother, he went to Canada and joined the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Mm-hmm. How about anybody before, you know, your father or his line?
No, my father wasn't in service.
Mm-hmm. Anybody before him?
Not that I recall. I had a cousin,
mm-hmm.
older cousin,
mm-hmm.
that he had been in the Spanish-American War.
Okay.
But I was so young then, I don't remember too much about it when he would stop by to visit, you know, sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then my mother, she had a brother that was in the Army during World War One.
Okay.
But that's about it.
Okay. What did you think about World War Two while you were in high school?
Well, I, of course, having two brothers in service,
mm-hmm.
and then the fact that the way the Japanese had attacked us at
mm-hmm.
Pearl Harbor
mm-hmm.
influenced all of us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we were just hoping that we would be victorious and defeat the Japanese and the Germans.
Did you follow the war on the radio?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Did you go to the Saturday picture show and see the newsreels?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we, at that time, we don't even have a theater here now, but back in those days, we did have one, and they'd have the newsreels
mm-hmm.
about the war.
Okay. Did your two brothers survive the war?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank goodness. Now, my brother that was in the Navy, he was severely wounded during the Coral Sea Battle.
Mm-hmm.
But he survived, thank goodness.
Okay. So, tell me again where you went to college in 1946.
Oh, well, I first went to Emory
uh-huh.
University down at Valdosta.
Mm-hmm.
It has now been closed. But I only went there a year, and
mm-hmm.
then transferred. Well, I went to Bob Jones University in
mm-hmm.
Greenville, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
It was rather a religious fanatic school.
Mm-hmm.
So after a year there, I had had enough of that. And that's when I transferred to Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College because my father just passed away. I was having to take over the management of the farm.
Okay.
But then they started to draft me. I didn't have quite enough credits for the Air Force for, you know, officers training and
mm-hmm.
pilot. So I transferred to Gordon Military College.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there for, I think it was a half year. Until I had my credits.
This is 1950?
That would have been in, I guess 1950. I went into the service the latter part of 50, I believe this was right.
Okay.
Just a minute, let me check my... I graduated in 47. I just saw that date.
47?
Yes.
From Gordon?
No, from Ashburn High School.
Oh, okay, 47.
I just happened to see that date.
Okay, so 1947 high school, then you went to Emory for a year.
Yeah.
Then Bob Jones University for a year. That would take us to 1949.
Yeah, and...
Then Abraham Ag.
Yeah, and I went at Gordon Military College. let's see, the first quarter, second quarter. I believe it was just two quarters. It could have been two and a half quarters. I don't recall those dates.
Okay. Okay.
But I while I was there, well, the draft board here was determined to draft me.
Okay.
And I like just one more subject, or I forget how many hours you get a credit, but mm-hmm. I went to the president and asked him if I could take an exam, and if I passed it, would they give me the credit for it, mm-hmm. since they were fixing the draft, and they agreed to.
Okay.
So I, and I forget now what subject that was in, but mm-hmm. I did pass, so they gave me the credits, and then I went right ahead and joined the Air Force.
Okay. And this was at Gordon when you...
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. How did you like the military life there at Gordon?
It was okay. It wasn't all that strict. I mean, we wore a uniform, mm-hmm. and but it really didn't have an awful lot of military training. Mm-hmm. But I imagine. Well, I don't know how they train them today in military. So some of them are real strict, some are lax.
Right, right. Now, did you think you enlisted in the Air Force? If you had been drafted, do you think you would have gone into the Army, probably?
Oh, yeah. If I'd been drafted, they would have put me in the Army, in the infantry, probably.
Okay. So, now where did you go when you enlisted?
Okay, well, I went to Shaw Air Force Base in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. At that time, my brother just happened to be stationed there, and so I went up there and took my exams for cadets. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness I passed them, and I had to go before board mm-hmm. and pass that okay. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, it would be approximately maybe 3 months before they had a class opening. Mm-hmm. So I just went ahead and enlisted in the regular Air Force.
Okay.
As an airman.
Okay.
I was sent to Lackland Air Force Base for basic training.
Okay.
After that, then they transferred me to, Perrin Air Force Base, I believe it was.
Okay.
And I just worked as a clerk there for about 2 months. Mm-hmm. And then they had an opening for me. And so then I was sent in to Malden, Missouri for basic pilot training and officers training.
Okay.
And we started out in the T-6.
The P-6?
Yes,
okay.
Single engine mm-hmm. plane, and for 6 months, and graduated from there. Then I was sent to, Perrin. Yeah, Perrin, back to Perrin.
Back to Perrin.
And trained in the B-25.
Okay.
And then graduated from that. Then I was commissioned as a second lieutenant.
Okay. Let me ask you, what did you think of President Truman and his handling of the Korean War and as a president in and of itself?
Well, as the president, I think he did the right thing in dropping the atomic bomb. Because a lot of people don't realize that it saved a lot more lives than were killed.
Yes, sir.
We killed more people in Tokyo when we firebombed it than
yes.
the atom bomb killed.
Yes, yes.
But a lot of people don't realize that. Now, I think he made a terrible mistake when he relieved MacArthur.
Mm-hmm.
at that time, had China joined in, we had the advantage in that we had the bomb and they didn't.
Right.
But unfortunately, when he relieved the Japanese, I happened to be stationed in Japan while MacArthur was still there.
Okay.
And the Japanese looked upon him with the same reverence that they looked upon their emperor.
Right.
And it was quite, I think it was more of a shock to them than it was to the Americans.
Okay. And how did you think about Truman's handling of the war itself on the ground?
Well, basically, I think... he did a good job. Lately, some of our presidents, for instance, in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
for instance,
mm-hmm.
Our hands were tied.
Mm-hmm.
We could not bomb or fight unless we had permission from Washington.
Right.
And you probably are aware that one Air Force general was relieved of duty because the Ho Chi Minh Trail that ran down from North Korea, North Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
came down through Laos, Cambodia, mm-hmm. then crossed into southern Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he went ahead and bombed it,
mm-hmm.
and because he was sick and tired of his people being ambushed and everything. As a result, they fired him.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about your basic training back at Lackland. What do you remember about that?
Well, at Lackland, we were living in tents,
mm-hmm.
dirt floor,
mm-hmm.
and rocks grew overnight.
Wow.
That was one of our jobs, picking out the rocks out of our tents every morning. But it was way over crack. Of course, it was during wartime.
Right.
And latrines, it was just a long ditch that was dug in the ground,
mm-hmm.
and out in the open. Well, they had a siege of people were fainting and passing out. They didn't even have enough ambulances to haul them all to the hospital.
Why were they fainting and passing?
I guess it was from food poisoning or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they finally shipped, I guess, a couple of thousand of us up to Wichita Falls.
Mm-hmm.
And we finished our training up there. There was a big congressional investigation about the conditions there then.
So it was pretty tough conditions.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, it wasn't too bad, other than having to pull KP. And
mm-hmm. What kind of weapons training did you receive there?
We got a little training in the M1.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, he did. And, my wife just interrupted.
Sorry. Okay. No problem. No problem at all.
We got training in the M1 and throwing hand grenades.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and the 45 automatic pistol.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that was about the basics of it.
Okay. Did the physical aspect of that basic training present problems for you, or were you in pretty good shape?
No, I got along okay.
Okay.
It wasn't until later that I had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that later in
okay.
the interview, I guess.
Okay, yes, sir, we will. Did you feel like you received good instruction there at Lackland?
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, basically instilling in people discipline and how to accept orders and
mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Does anything stand out in your mind about that training besides the fainting and passing out incident?
No, not too much. It was pretty well just, you know, basic. After we got up to Wichita Falls, my brother that's in the Air Force happened to fly out to see and drop by to see me, and we were standing, well, he'd gone to our orderly room, and they had paged me, and we were standing outside. Another airman in fatigues like I was came by. I saluted him.
Right.
My brother laughed. He says, "You salute the basic airman." I said, "I salute anything that moves."
Just to be safe.
Right.
Right. Okay, so when you went to Perrin Air Force Base, you basically had a desk job as a clerk there?
Yes.
Okay. And how did you like that?
It was okay. What? It was sort of like my job, new people coming in or people going out. We had a sort of like a locator service, and I handled all that. And I'd have to index everybody's name, their phone numbers, et cetera, how they could be located.
And how long were you there at Perrin?
About 2 months.
And then you went to your advanced
training. Yes.
At Malden.
Right.
Now, what was it like when you received your first flying lessons?
They're very interesting. Of course, your first flight, you're not even handling the controls. You're,
right.
You know, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And
do you remember your first flight? Just your first flight, not when you were flying, but before that, when someone else is flying you.
After I'm in the Air Force?
Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. Your very first flight at Malden.
No, I really don't remember anything about the first flight. I remember my solo flight.
What was that like? Is this your very first one?
The first time that the instructor let me take the plane up by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the winter.
Okay.
And there was a lot of snow there then in Missouri. And the T-6 was real bad about, you know, the yaw. So I took off okay, and when I came around to land, I went off the runway. I didn't hurt the plane or nothing. But right away, my instructor came running up, jumped in, and said, "Go around again." And so he took me around again, shot another two landings, then he got back out. He says, "All right, now go ahead and do it right this time." So fortunately, I did stay on the runway when I landed then. But, and everyone that soloed that day, the custom was, after we got back to our hooch area, they grabbed us, took us down to the swimming pool. They had to break the ice and threw us all in. And I tell you, it was cool.
This is your initiation, basically?
Right.
Okay. Wow. So what else do you remember about your advanced training? This is your basic pilot training.
Right. Oh, one thing that I do recall during the basic training.
This is like back at Lackland?
No, this is back at Malden.
At Malden, okay.
It was a terrible winter, and all the power in that area of Missouri was out. We had no heat in our quarters or anything, so they had issued us sleeping bags and extra blankets, and we just darn near froze to death there for about 4 days. Finally, they found a carnival that was wintering somewhere, and they managed to get their generators and all, and that way we managed to get heat again.
Okay. Yeah. Now, what kind of officer training did you go through there at Malden?
It was basically academic work, military studies, and then, of course, flight engineering, weather training, and all. And, of course, the same was true when we went to advanced and continued studies in military tactics and all. And then, of course, we'd have about a half a day of academic work and about a half a day of flying training.
Okay.
And, of course, in the flying training, you were having instructions on maintenance of aircraft, et cetera. Excuse me. And all.
How did you enjoy flying?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I really miss it today.
Okay, so how long were you there at Malden?
It was, let's see. Well, I guess it was about 6 months at Malden, about 6 months at advanced training.
And then you went to Perrin and did the
25? No, 6 months at Malden for basic training, and then 6 months up at Perrin for advanced training.
Okay.
And then when I was commissioned then, graduated, then I was transferred. They first sent me down to Fort Benning, Georgia, which is an army, one of the largest army bases in the States. And we trained in the C-46, which is a big twin-engine transport. And we trained in dropping paratroopers and checking out in the C-46. I was there for about, roughly maybe about 2 months or 3 months, I'd forget.
Now, you had trained in the B-25, right, previous
right,
to this.
Yeah.
How was it flying the larger aircraft? Was it more difficult for you?
No. Actually, through my career, I have found that going from a smaller plane to a larger one is easier than going from a large one to a small one.
Okay. Why is that?
Good question.
What do you think?
I think the main reason, if you go from a big plane to a smaller one, you probably over control.
Okay.
But after our combat crew training at Fort Benning, then I left for Japan. And,
what year was this?
This would have been in 51.
Okay.
And when I arrived in Japan, well, a lot of us that had trained there together on the C-46s, we were all sent down to Brady to fly. They had a C-46 group there. And we were flying personnel, supplies, you name it. We were flying it.
Oh, just to Korea or all over
All over Korea.
Okay.
And we'd go over, take a load of stuff over. We might get, after we offloaded that, they might put on wounded personnel or the mail or dead soldiers that were in body bags. It just depended on what needed to be transported.
Okay. How did you feel about flying into a combat zone?
That didn't worry me too much. The only thing I worried about was maybe being going down in a plane and the gorillas capturing me, because they usually didn't keep you alive very long.
Right.
But now going into Seoul, especially at night, you had to be very careful because the homing device, there's some big mountains around Seoul. And one of the big mountains is in the northern sector, mm-hmm. and the enemy used to tune in on the same frequency, which would try to lure you into that mountain.
Wow.
So you had to keep double-checking to make sure you weren't homing in on the wrong homer.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any difficulties?
No. Of course, there was a few times that my homer would pick up the other one, mm-hmm. the enemy's, but by cross-checking with some of the other homers, mm-hmm. you could double-check your position. And
you need to take a break, sir?
No, I've got some hot tea here. Let me take a sip of that.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so did you ever have any memorable experiences there flying on this mission here and when you're based out of Japan?
No. After the armistice, mm-hmm. then the next summer, mm-hmm. They equipped one of our C-46s with a huge tank in it and mounted a pipe underneath the plane across the rear elevators. Mm-hmm. And I was sent over, and I was spraying DDT mm-hmm. over the UN bases and the large cities in South Korea. And all that was for, insect control and,
right.
and everything.
Right.
This was done at just treetop or housetop level.
Wow.
And
you still find the C-46?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was funny, though, we'd flying over Seoul or Daegu or Busan or some of those cities, you make one or two passes. And when you come back, all these kids have their kites up. And they'd string them way up where we'd have to fly through them and uh-huh. cut their strings,
Uh-huh.
So
it was like
kids were just having a lot of fun with us.
That's funny. What did you think of the Japanese people while you were stationed in Japan?
I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I sure did. Mm-hmm. And that was my first tour. When we got to my second tour, it was even better.
Okay. How old were you when you were first sent over to Japan?
Oh, gosh. I see, I was born in December of 1928. Oh, just a minute.
Maybe 23?
I guess I was, in my early 20s.
Okay.
I'd be in my early 20s.
Okay.
Sometime along there.
Okay. How long was this tour in Japan? Was it a 2-year?
It was supposed to have been for, just a year, but after the army spooked in, they extended us all to an 18-month tour.
Okay. And did you the DDT flying after the armistice?
Yes.
Okay. And what did you think of the outcome of the war?
it's sort of hurt our feelings that we had to give up all that profit of land that MacArthur had taken
mm-hmm.
when we had to move back to the 38th parallel.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess all in all, it was all right.
Okay. And after your Japan tour, where were you sent then?
Okay, well, after I came back from Korea, mm-hmm. I was, let's see, where did I go then?
Texas at El Paso?
Oh, I went to El Paso, Texas.
Okay.
And it was I was stationed at Biggs, which is a SAC base, but I was under TAC.
Okay.
TAC had a tow target squadron there where we towed targets. We were flying. They had B-26s and B-29s.
Mm-hmm.
And the B-26s would tow targets for the Army there to fire at. Mm-hmm. Or B-29s, we'd send those up to Alaska and Thule, Greenland, and Goose Bay for on temporary duties, usually about 30 to 45 days at a clip.
Okay. You would fly them up there?
Yes. Well, I was sent there. They had one C-47,
mm-hmm.
and I was sent there to fly that. It's similar to the C-46, but just a little smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But I went ahead and checked out in the B-26 and the B-29,
okay.
and flew all three.
Which of those three were your favorite? Was your favorite aircraft?
The B-29.
Why was that?
Well, it had four engines, and it was pressurized.
Okay. That makes a difference.
Yeah, it was real comfortable and real nice to fly.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. And, of course, when you took off in that, you were really building up your time, too, because it was long missions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was that your favorite aircraft that you had flown? Up to that point?
Up to that point, yes.
Okay. And how long were you in El Paso?
Let's see. Check my book right quick.
Okay.
Okay. December of 54, I got there. Okay, let's see, from 54 to 57, I guess.
Okay, so 3 years, basically?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then from El Paso, after my tour there, I was sent back to Korea and was stationed at Osan Air Base.
Mm-hmm.
That was in a top secret operation. We had four C-47s with fuselage. We had tape recorders and everything, and people from security service operated those for us. We would fly up to, it was northwest of Korea. The Russians had a base at Port Arthur.
Right.
And we would go up and orbit for about usually 5 to 6 hours at a time, just taping all their conversations and eavesdropping on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we flied two missions a day, one in the morning, one in the evening.
Okay.
And then sometimes if the weather was just too bad where we couldn't get up in that area, we'd go up to the northeast, up towards the islands that Russia had up there, up around Vladivostok, up at that general area.
Okay. Now, were you made aware of exactly what your mission was?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And how many personnel did you have on board the flight?
Okay, well, it'd be pilot, co-pilot, engineer, and then usually we had about 4 to 5 security people that were operating the tape recorders.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, they were operating each one on different frequencies and all. And in the Port Arthur area several times. We had a radar site.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little, I guess it was in the area of the 38th parallel, but there were three little islands up here. Mm-hmm. South Korea had one, mm-hmm. and the North Koreans had two of them. Mm-hmm. And we did have a radar station on the one that South Korea owned. And they would help watch if they spotted any, what was the Brussels plane?
MiGs?
Yeah, like MiGs. Mm-hmm. If they spotted any coming out of Port Arthur in our direction, they'd notify us. And mm-hmm. we'd do a 180 and fireball it, trying to get out of there.
Now, were you in Russian airspace?
We didn't actually enter into their space, mm-hmm. but, of course, they claimed it. But
right.
According to our regulations, we were in international airspace.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you have any memorable incidents happen to you when you were doing these missions?
No. Not in that outfit. The Navy, I know we were out one day orbiting, and the radar advised us that planes were in the area, so we turned and started coming back. Mm-hmm. That same day, the Navy was also doing the same thing, but they were in a different area. They did have a plane shot down that day.
Really? So they would freely fire upon you?
Oh, yeah.
Even if you weren't in their airspace?
According to us,
uh-huh.
we were not in their airspace. According to them, we were.
Okay, so you were a sitting duck if these
right.
guys came up on you.
Right.
Okay. Was this stuff, since this was top secret, I mean, did this stuff was not reported back, the shoot down of this plane, was it reported back to the families or what?
I don't know how the Navy handled that.
Did they tell you how they would handle yours if you were shot down?
No. No, they never informed us about that.
Okay. And you flew, according to your notes, 145 of these combat spy missions?
That sounds about right.
Okay. Okay. And this went on for, what, a year or so?
Yeah, I guess. I think I was just over a year, but I can't say for sure. I don't have those notes handy on me. But after I finished that tour, uh-huh. and I took a concurrent tour uh-huh. in Japan,
okay.
and I was stationed at Tachikawa Air Base.
Mm-hmm. And what was your mission there?
I was sent over there, started out in the C-47s again. It was the SAM squadron, special air missions.
Mm-hmm.
High-ranking officers, and civilian dignitaries mm-hmm. and all, when they would come over to the Far East, they'd usually either come over commercial or on MAC flights.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would pick them up and fly them throughout the Far East,
okay.
Either over Japan to Hong Kong to Vietnam mm-hmm. or Thailand, wherever they needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an instructor and test pilot there.
Instructor and test pilot?
Yes. And so I was also assigned, I used to fly the Japanese Imperial staff
mm-hmm.
when they would go around Japan inspecting their bases.
What was it like meeting?
Oh, that was excellent. Because when we'd land, the Japanese, they really gave us the first-class treatment, too.
Mm-hmm. What would they do for you?
Well, they'd put us up in a real nice Japanese hotel, and then usually one of the managers or assistant managers or they'd take us out for dinner, and
mm-hmm.
excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, I don't know, I guess they must have had it in the Japanese papers,
mm-hmm.
because I know on one trip, a radio operator. He had gone out and gotten sort of tipsy and forgot what hotel he was at.
Right.
And he just asked some Japanese. He says, "Oh, you're staying in such and such a hotel."
So they knew exactly where you were.
Right. And it was. I used to always instruct my crews when we were flying around in Japan at different places. If they went into a Japanese club or cabaret or anything, some of them, you know, didn't want Americans in there. And I said, if they sort of raised their hand, just be polite, turn around, and go on somewhere else.
Why do they not want Americans in there?
Well,
this was in 1960, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess some of them just didn't want Americans around.
Okay.
But when we flew the Japanese staff around, we were welcome wherever we went.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing, the change.
Yeah. Do you remember any of the other dignitaries that you flew around?
I tell you, I flew so many generals and admirals. I don't even remember who all I did fly, but I did fly Floyd Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, he was in charge of all foreign aid.
Okay.
And, of course, taking him around every place we'd land, they rolled out the red carpet,
mm-hmm.
bands playing, and
right.
everything, first-class treatment.
Now, how much contact did you have with your family back in Georgia?
Just letters.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever, of course, I was single then. And,
mm-hmm.
Just whenever, you know, the mail ran, or whenever somebody felt like writing.
Mm-hmm. Was your family supportive of you in the military?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So after that, that in 1960 in Japan, that tour lasted how long? For about a year?
No, I was there longer than that. Let's see. I got there. I don't have that bloody date. But after I had been there, I guess for a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
they called me in one day and told me that I was being assigned to a secret assignment.
Okay.
And the Air Force had picked a flight crew and a ground crew
mm-hmm.
on a very top secret assignment.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent us back to the United States. We went there, and this has been declassified.
Right, right.
It was Project Hilo Hattie.
Okay.
C-54, that's a four-engine
mm-hmm.
plane.
Mm-hmm.
And we came back to Fort Worth, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And there they had taken an old C-54 and had put all kinds of cameras, detections, if you think, name it, they had it.
Okay.
And we stayed there about 1.5 months, maybe,
mm-hmm.
checking out on all these systems. And we used to have to take off. We'd take off late in the afternoon so as to arrive over the Eglin Proving Grounds. That's down in Florida in the Panhandle.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
We didn't land there, but they set aside an area there where we could fly and to check out all our equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd fly back to Fort Worth.
Okay.
And the security people, about every week, they'd move us to a different hotel. And so when we finally got checked out on everything, mm-hmm. oh, and the most unusual thing about this plane, mm-hmm. now, most any airplane, as you fly and burn off fuel, mm-hmm. You usually pick up speed and get better consumption mm-hmm. on your fuel. This plane was exactly opposite. The only thing we could figure out was it was the delta factor, which is being so old, accumulation of dirt, loose nuts and bolts mm-hmm. that had been dropped inside different areas and all. It actually started consuming more fuel. So we had, of course, flying back and forth to Florida as many times as we did. I had three navigators on board. And we always ran fuel consumption charts on every flight.
Right.
So we figured that going from California to Hawaii, we would have to have a zero wind factor.
Okay.
Well, they staged us through McClellan Air Force Base, which was at Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And we got there, well, waiting for a zero wind factor. Lord, we sat on the ground there for about, around 5 or 6 days.
Hmm.
Finally, they forecast a zero wind factor. So we got ready to take off. And I said, well, look, we're going to stop at Hamilton and top off our fuel tanks.
Mm-hmm.
Hamilton is just across the bay from San Francisco, and there was an Air Force base there. And fortunately, and thank goodness, we did stop and top them off, because during the night we had already passed the point of no return, and my senior navigator came up and shook his head. He had been asleep,
mm-hmm.
and these two other navigators, they were lieutenants,
mm-hmm.
and this captain came up, he says, we are in deep kimchi. We have picked up a 15-knot headwind.
Mm.
And when he said that, I just banked over about 30 degrees to the left.
Mm-hmm.
Told him, I said, give me a heading for Hilo.
Mm-hmm.
Hilo sits quite a few miles further east than Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I started a slow letdown. And we sent out an SOS. But we finally made it into Hilo, and we had about 15 minutes worth of fuel left when we landed.
Wow. Was that your closest call?
Yeah, I guess up to that time.
Okay.
Well, I did have, back before I got on this assignment, I had a pretty close call on C-47. We used to send our planes, our C-47s,
mm-hmm.
down to Hong Kong for what we call Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It's where they take them apart, replace any worn parts, rebuild them, and everything. And we had sent another crew down to pick it up, but the pilot got a notice from the States that there'd been a death in his family, so the Air Force had him just catch a plane out of Hong Kong back to the States. They called me out and sent me down commercially to Hong Kong to fly it back. And when I got down there, I got down there late one night. I was going to take off the next day to bring it back. And service people that were there on leave or R&R,
mm-hmm.
Some of them stationed in Okinawa. And I think there were one or two from, Taiwan. Mexico and then into Japan.
Okay.
Well, the weather was real bad. It was really raining, but the weather there at Hong Kong, we thought we'd be out of it pretty quick, you know. So we took off and got up to our altitude about 8,000 or 9,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
leveled off. Now, it was such a bad electrical storm, my navigator couldn't get any readings off of his equipment,
mm-hmm.
or anything. We couldn't pick up anything either on our radios.
Mm-hmm.
And about that time, my number two engine was about to blow up.
Okay.
I didn't feather it, but I had to reduce the power where it just pulled its own weight.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a 180 and headed back towards Hong Kong. And going in, well, I don't know whether you've ever been in Hong Kong or not, but
yes, sir.
The runway is dredged up in the bay there.
Mm-hmm.
There's mountains all around it.
Mm-hmm.
Once you pass the outer marker, you're committed.
Okay.
And especially on a single engine, you are definitely committed.
To landing.
Right.
Okay.
And I was coming in on final. Well, it was 0-0. No visibility at all. And
mm-hmm.
Fortunately, they had a... Do you know what ILS is?
IOSS?
ILS. It's an instrument landing system.
No, I don't. Okay.
Oh, well, it normally gives you a course,
mm-hmm.
and a glide scope.
Okay.
Well, the course line, let's see, the glide scope,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't receive it, but I did get the course line, and the GCA was bringing me in, too, and all at once they called me, they said, just continue a normal rate of descent, we've completely lost you due to the heavy rain. Well, I told the engineer, I said, go back and tell everybody to brace for a possible crash landing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just set up a 500 foot a minute descent.
Mm-hmm.
And looking out the side of the window, all at once I saw some lights go by.
Mm-hmm.
And I just cut the power and made a beautiful landing. But after I landed,
uh-huh.
turned off the runway, then my legs started shaking so bad I had to have my co-pilot taxi it on in.
Oh, really? Wow.
So I told everyone, I said, well, that'll do it for today. I said, if they get this thing fixed, we'll depart tomorrow morning.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, none of my passengers showed up. I think they decided to go commercial.
Oh, that's funny. Okay.
Well, I know one day at the races, we had a winning ticket, but we had thrown the ticket away before we realized it was a winning ticket. But
All right.
But I really can't think of anything offhand.
Okay. Do you think the United States learned any lessons from the Vietnam War?
I sure hope they have.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I don't know whether you heard that racket going by or not.
Yes, sir.
Some guy on a motorcycle racing up and down the street here.
Okay.
What was your question?
Well, what lessons have the United States learned from the Vietnam War, do you think?
Well, I hope they've learned that you can't win a war if you have to depend on getting everything okay through Washington first.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was more or less proven in Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
They gave General Schwarzkopf the go-ahead and left him alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you see what a wonderful and fast job he did. Unfortunately, if we go back into there, I'm afraid it's going to be devastating because he's had too many years to build up and anticipation of this.
If you were to tell young people today about the Vietnam War and about your experiences, what would you tell them about Vietnam?
Well, about the only thing I could tell them would be that they're fairly friendly people, and it is a beautiful country. Of course, it's been torn up a lot, but I think at one time it was referred to as the Pearl of the Orient or the something like that. I forget the correct wording. But that's about all I could say for it. They're industrious.
Okay. Have you ever been to Washington, D.C. and to the Vietnam War Memorial?
No, I haven't.
Would you like to go someday?
Yeah. I think it would be real interesting to see it. Offhand, I really don't know of any friend that was killed there. But I would like to see the wall.
Okay. You said that every 5 years the government's been flying you out to La Jolla to get tested.
Right.
Is it that's continuing?
No. Okay. This year was the last year.
Okay. Okay. Do you feel like the government is taking care of its Vietnam veterans?
Not really.
How so?
Well, so much of it, you know, they keep denying. Now, I myself, if I get sick, I go to a private doctor.
You don't go to the VA?
No, I don't go to the VA or to a base.
Okay.
And
well, Mr. Harp, is there anything else you'd like to talk about or anything else you'd like to add to this interview?
I can't think of anything now. Maybe when you send me the draft, if I think of anything more, I can maybe add to it. But offhand right now, I don't think of anything.
Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and wrap it up then.
Okay.
And this will end our oral history interview with Mr. David Harp. Okay, sir, if you could continue talking about Hilo Hattie.
Okay. Well, as I said, we arrived at Hilo with only about 15 minutes of fuel remaining.
Right. Now, is this your first mission out there? Your first flight out there, or was this just...
On Hilo Hattie, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, after refueling and all, then we flew on up to Hickam. And there we were met by the admirals and generals of PACAP headquarters and briefed. And we, on our way over, of course, all our reports and everything had to be encrypted and everything, which was a big headache.
What was involved in that procedure?
Well, you're giving your position, your altitude, flight conditions, and everything. But we had to encode it in a secret thing. You know, they change the books every day.
Okay.
And it was a real headache. So I asked one of the admirals. He asked, well, of course, they were talking to us about our fuel problem. And did we have any other problem? I said, yes. I said, my squadron at Tachikawa that they'd picked me from, I said, they have a plane, they have a C-54 sitting in Hong Kong going through Iran. Mm-hmm. I said, could we just paint those numbers on this airplane, and then we can broadcast in the open? It'll make it so much easier. Mm-hmm. He said, sure. So they rolled it into a hangar, repainted the numbers on it, mm-hmm. and then our security forces, I guess back here at the States, they completely lost us. So we took off from Hawaii then and flew to, we stopped at Midway and refueled, and then Guam, mm-hmm. and then into Yokota Air Base. Mm-hmm. And because of the secrecy of this mission, they transferred me on paper from Tachikawa over to Yokota. Mm-hmm. And there at Yokota, they have a had a extra hangar that was big enough that we could put the C-54 in. And mm-hmm. they had placed guards around it so nobody could get into it. Mm-hmm. The way the plane was constructed, all this equipment, we had secret panels mm-hmm. that opened up. And thought we had a 100-inch lens on one camera. It was a huge thing, and it was on a little tiny rails mm-hmm. with an electric motor where it could be moved to one side of the plane or the other.
Right.
And those hydraulic doors that were about maybe 2 feet wide and mm-hmm. about 4 feet high. Mm-hmm. But when those panels were closed, you could walk around the outside of the plane. You would never find it. Hmm. It fit so tight. Same okay. way under the fuselage, we had numerous panels under there that would open up different types of cameras and flare drops, etc. And as far as this huge camera, well, when we'd land someplace, we'd roll it to one side. Mm-hmm. And we had these panels that we put up that made it look like we had extra fuel tanks there mm-hmm. that actually had valves and lights that would light up and
okay.
everything to, you know, to camouflage it.
Uh-huh.
So after we got back to Yokota then. We had, you know, any minor maintenance that we had to take care of. And mm-hmm. then we were taking, we never had orders sending us to Vietnam.
Okay.
And they told us that if we did go down, they would deny us.
Okay.
And on paper, the plane belonged to some outfit in Washington State.
Okay.
I forget what outfit it was supposed to belong to. Mm-hmm. But that was sort of stupid because still on the airplane it had U.S. Air Force written on it. But,
so what? How do they describe your mission to you?
Well, what we did, we, at that time, see, this was in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have any up-to-date charts or maps of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And officially, see, the war hadn't started.
Right.
But although we did get a lot of small arms fire, we were fortunate we never got hit.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, the Vietnamese hadn't learned to lead their sights. They'd shoot directly at the plane and it missed us. But we mapped all of South Vietnam and all along the Laos and Cambodian borders
mm-hmm.
and all.
Okay.
And also, there were a time or two at night, we flew, blackout
mm-hmm.
at night. And every once in a while, our radio operators, they had picked up some Vietnamese pilot, South Vietnamese pilot,
mm-hmm.
that was calling in for the that he had an unknown airplane coming in from Laos or Cambodia or somewhere, mm-hmm. and was asking permission to shoot it down.
And that was you?
Yes.
Okay.
So that would upset us quite a bit. But unfortunately, well, thank goodness they had to call in, too, to their command center, and they were told not to fire on it. So finally, after about a, well, we spent about a year there.
Okay. Now, you flew from Japan. Is that correct?
We flew from Japan and stopped in Philippines to refuel, take care of any minor maintenance, and then on to Vietnam.
Okay. And how many missions would you fly a day, or is it just one
day? Usually... we'd fly a daylight mission, and then we'd fly a night mission.
Okay.
And depending on the requirements. And let's see, what was I leading up to?
Well, let me ask you about the plane. Was the plane easy to handle with all that equipment on it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No problems there?
No, okay. We didn't have any problems there.
Do you know how they picked you to fly it?
No, I don't. I guess because I was a bachelor.
Okay.
In fact, most of the crew were single.
Okay.
And, of course, I'd had a lot of experience, you know, flying in the Far East. Mm-hmm. And I guess that was one of the criterias. Mm-hmm. But after about a year there, then they had a Globemaster, what was that plane called? Pan Am used to fly them across the Pacific. It was a big four-engine plane. Mm-hmm. It was a takeoff on after World War II ended, and there was a shortage of commercial aircraft. They took the basic design of the B-29 and changed it some and made a passenger version. And I've forgotten now what they call that plane.
Okay.
But if it comes to me between the time that you send me the thing to look over, I'll try to jot that in.
Okay, great. Good.
But anyhow, they sent this plane down to replace us. So we flew back to Japan, and then from Japan, we brought the plane back to Fort Worth, where it was taken apart, all the equipment taken out, and the plane was destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get to see the result of any of your missions, any of the maps? And
no, I didn't.
Okay.
Never did. It would be interesting to see. I do have a picture, though, that coming back into Japan on one flight. Well, I'll back up. When we had to have any major maintenance or inspections, we would have to take the plane back to Yokota to this secure hangar.
Right.
And we'd work on it there. Mm-hmm. And when we got through, then we'd go back to Vietnam.
Okay.
And one interesting aspect about that particular mission, when we arrived, like I said, we had no orders to send us there. So we were the old Majestic Hotel in Saigon. Mm-hmm. We started holding up there. Well, the whole crew, we were crowded into this suite that had about three or four small rooms.
Okay.
We were packed in there like sardines.
Okay.
Well, when I was flying Floyd Hamilton, and when we were in Saigon with him, they had assigned this Chinese chap by the name, believe it or not, Charlie Chan. Well, after a while, being so cooped up like we were in this hotel, I said, I'm going to try to find this guy. Well, I finally located him, and So I told him, well, I previously had gone to some real estate people Villa, mm-hmm. where our crew could all stay.
Now, which crew? This is the
Hilo Hattie.
This is the Hilo Hattie crew.
Yes.
So you actually stationed in Saigon for a period of time.
I was living in Saigon.
Okay. Okay.
I wasn't stationed there.
Okay. Right. Okay.
But the real estate people, most of them were Frenchmen, mm-hmm. and even though I had offered them as much as $4,000 a month. Rent.
Wow.
They insisted we sign a lease agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to explain to them that I could not sign anything. I said, we'll pay you in advance.
Right.
But they were insisting we sign. Well, that didn't work out.
Okay.
So after I contacted this Charlie Chan,
mm-hmm.
he introduced me to a Chinese friend of his there in Saigon that was real wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And over in Cholon, which is a suburb of Saigon,
mm-hmm.
it's a Chinese district,
mm-hmm.
This chap owned a three-story building that at one time had been a school.
Okay.
And so he agreed to remodel it and rent it to us.
Okay.
And he did a beautiful job on it. And so then we moved in there, and he seemed to enjoy being around us.
Mm-hmm.
Even up on the roof, he fixed it up, put in some barbecue places
mm-hmm.
up there, and he had actually furnished us the food, the barbecue and everything.
Hmm. Wow.
He'd bring his family over, and we'd party and everything. And,
mm-hmm.
and one funny thing, well, our second floor had this little narrow balcony.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times when we'd come in from a flight, we'd grab a beer out of our he'd even put refrigerators and air conditioners in all our rooms.
Wow.
And we'd grab a beer and go out and stand on the balcony and watch the girls pedaling by on their motorcycles
mm-hmm.
or motorbike or bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
We'd lean on this balcony, which was just had a concrete top.
Mm-hmm.
Well, leaning against that concrete would leave indentations on your arm and,
mm-hmm.
and everything. So I told him one day, I said, gee whiz, it'd be nice if you had towel on this.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, when we came in from a flight, he had already had a crew up there and had laid towel all the way across.
Wow.
The top of the balcony.
Wow. He took care of you.
Right.
Yeah. What were your impressions of Saigon?
Well, it was a beautiful city
mm-hmm.
at one time.
Mm-hmm.
The downtown part was still real clean.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever been there?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you have?
Yes, sir.
Were you in service?
No, sir, I was not. I was there on an academic and research mission.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. Well, to me, it was a beautiful city,
mm-hmm.
and tree-lined and everything. I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And
were you able to kind of come and go as you pleased once you finished your flying that day?
Yeah.
Or that
mm-hmm.
night? So there were no restrictions on you at all?
No, huh?
You could interact with the natives? And
yeah, and the funny thing was, if I started out, after we moved into this hotel in Cholon,
mm-hmm.
When I'd go out, you know, like alone,
mm-hmm.
I found out that this Chinese guy would have somebody following me,
mm-hmm.
I guess in case anything happened, but
right.
it never did.
Okay. Following you to protect you? Or?
Yeah, I
okay.
guess so.
Okay. Do you remember any significant incidents that happened while you were there in Saigon, in the city?
No. Not that I recall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of anything.
Do you remember?
The security service had us get out of that Saigon because they had gotten word that I don't know whether it was the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese had put a price on us.
Oh, really?
And on any crew member that they could get their hands on to find out what we were doing and everything. So we took off and went over to the Philippines for a few days.
And you heard no more of that?
No.
Did you have any problems with the Vietnamese language or Vietnamese culture adapting to it?
No. The language, I never could master that or anything.
Right.
But Japanese was real easy to pick up. But the Vietnamese and Chinese language, I could never master. But as far as the people and all, we got along fine.
Okay. How many men were on your flight crew?
Oh, gosh. I mean, let's see. Wait a minute. I got a plaque here.
Got 11. Did you receive a plaque for this operation?
Well, when they assigned us over to Yokota, they put us under the administration of the 41st Air Division. And because we were flying so many hours, we started winning all their quarterly awards. It was a reconnaissance outfit, but they were so upset about it because we took all the glory away from them. Like we flew so many hours that a lot of our hours we couldn't record because you're only, under Air Force regulations, you can't fly over a certain amount of hours in 1 month, which I believe is around 140. I'm not sure. I don't recall. I think it was 140, but we were exceeding that. So once we hit 140, we just quit logging it.
Right. Okay. So you had 11 men on board.
Yes.
Okay. And did the intelligence officers, did they bunk with you there in Cholon? Or?
We had some people. It was a couple of guys from the CIA. There was one guy from the, this sounds funny, Singer Sewing Machine.
He was from, say that again, he was from the Singer Sewing
Machine? Singer Sewing Machine.
That was what he was operating under?
Yeah, evidently.
Okay. All right.
Heck of a nice guy, but there were quite a few civilians there. They didn't fly on the missions with us.
Okay.
But they were there with us.
Okay. Do you remember any of the protests that were going on against President Ngo Dinh Diem in Saigon there when you were there in the early 60s?
just vaguely.
Okay.
Just vaguely.
Okay.
But I don't recall any of the Pacific problems there.
What did you think of Vietnam country itself?
Well, flying over it, it appeared to be very beautiful, especially when you'd fly over some of these rubber plantations and see these mansions, French-style design, sitting out there in the jungle. It was very impressive looking. And in fact, I happened to meet one Frenchman that had a plantation, these Chinese friends on Sundays, if we happened to be standing down, they'd take a bunch of us out to the racetrack, horse racetrack. And that's how I happened to meet him.
Okay.
And
what would you do for entertainment there in Saigon?
Well, we didn't have much time. Entertainment. We'd go down to one of the cabarets and drink beer and, and fact, the my first night there, when we first arrived, they have a local beer called, we call it Tutiwa. And unfortunately, the first night, that's what we were drinking. The next morning, when I woke up, I had a splitting headache. I tried to sit up, and I couldn't see anything. I thought, oh, my God, I've gone blind. but in about a few minutes, well, then my eyes started focusing. And but after that escapade, then we stuck to the good old American beer.
How many Americans did you see in Saigon?
Well, we would see quite a few. Of course, you know, the Army, although it wasn't admitted, they had quite a build-up. We'd see quite a few soldiers, and we'd see quite a few people in civilian clothes, Americans. I didn't know whether they were Army just putting on civilian clothes or whether they were intelligence people or what.
Now, this was 1961, and how long did it go in this Hilo Hattie project?
We were there for a year.
Okay.
And the plane that replaced us, I don't know how long they stayed there.
Okay. So what did you do after Project Hilo Hattie?
Okay, after Hilo Hattie, I came back to the States, and let's see. Then I was stationed at, I was assigned to Randolph Air Force Base, Texas.
Okay.
And there I was assigned as the squadron administrative officer, flight scheduling officer, and I was a test pilot, and also where I had to give the pilots check rides, stuff like that.
Flight instructor?
Right.
Okay. What planes were you checking out in yourself?
Okay, well, there at Randolph, and that was a squad, Special Air Mission Squadron, too. I was flying the C-47 again. Well, it's called a VC-47 because they were real plushed up. And the VT-29 and the VC-131, which is the same as the T-29, it's just a little bit different in the engine.
Okay. And how long were you there at Randolph?
At Randolph, let me see.
This would have been 1962.
Okay.
While you're doing that, your notes said that you flew 76 combat missions for Hilo Hattie. Does that sound about right?
Let me see. I've got another paper here, I think. Hilo Hattie, something like that. 76, yeah.
Okay. So you're a flight instructor, and
flight of standardization and flight evaluation.
Okay.
Yeah, I got it now.
Okay. All right. And what rank were you at this point?
Let me see. Going into it. I was the captain.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you know how long you're there at Randolph? 62 to...
Okay.
I have
19...
I have here that you were at Benoit in 1968.
Yeah.
So you were there.
So I was 1968 was when I went back to Southeast Asia.
Okay. So that would have been 6 years at Randolph?
Approximately.
Okay, okay. You didn't go anywhere else between Randolph and going back to Southeast Asia?
No.
Okay, okay.
No. It was in, let's see, 1968. I was sent down to Hurlburt Air Force Base in Florida, and it's in the Panhandle. And there I was checked out in the C-123,
okay.
which they use for spray missions.
Right, right.
And then after we completed our training, then we were sent to the Philippines to go through Jungle Survival School.
Okay.
And that was for about 2 weeks, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. How was that?
It wasn't too bad. We learned they had these natives showing us what plants we could eat and how to cook rice and bamboo stick and different things. And so then when we finished there, then we went over to Benoit.
Were you able to handle all that physically okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, going back to Randolph quickly, this is the first time you've come back to the United States in quite some time.
Right.
How did it feel being back in the United States? Did you prefer that?
Of course, I enjoyed being stationed in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good assignment. And then Randolph is a beautiful base. And, of course, San Antonio's a nice-sized city and lots to do there. Backing up, when I was first assigned, it was my second tour in Korea, when I went to Ulsan, I had to go through survival training at Reno, Nevada.
Okay.
And now that was rough.
Really?
The first week, you're being treated as though you have been captured. And you're put in these little sweat boxes, different things. And the last few days of the second week, they take you up in the mountains and dump you out, and you have to cover, I don't know how many miles you have to cover to get to the point where they'll pick you up again. So you spend a couple of nights in the mountains hiking over, and I learned two things. If you go for a week without eating, you get extremely hungry. And if you walk up and down those mountains, you get awful tired. So when I had to go back to Vietnam, to Benoit, of course I was stationed at Randolph then, and when they personnel notified me there, and the sergeant told me, he says, "Oh, you've got to go back through survival training." I said, "No way." I said, I don't mind going back to Vietnam, but I said, "I will stand a court-martial before I'll go back through that survival training in Reno." And he said, "Oh, you don't know." I said, "I most certainly do." And we argued back. Finally, he picked up the phone, called, and said, by then I was a major. And he said, "Major Harp doesn't have to go back." So they waived it.
So you would have had to go back to Reno.
Supposedly.
But you did?
No.
You did go to the Philippines, though.
That was jungle survival.
So that was much easier.
Yeah, much easier.
Okay. And what other training did they have for you before you went to Benoit?
Well, that was basically all it.
Okay.
The the checking out in the plane down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And
C-133?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And then the jungle survival training in the Philippines, mm-hmm. and straight to Vietnam again.
Now, how had Vietnam changed? This was 1968. This is quite a bit of time that passed.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, we were more or less restricted to Ben Hoa. It's I don't know how many miles north of Saigon it is. It's I guess a couple of hours drive by jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time I was there, I only got to go into Saigon once.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in bad shape then.
What do you
know?
Mean?
Garbage around and
mm-hmm.
Everything. And in fact, I tried to locate some of my Chinese friends, but mm-hmm. never could locate any of them. And in one place, they thought that this Charlie Chan had died,
okay.
But I never could verify that.
Mm-hmm. What was Vietnam the country like? Had it changed a lot since the early 60s?
Well, the country, I really couldn't say much because, see, when I was first there,
mm-hmm.
Like on Hilo Hattie, I didn't see the country except from the air.
Mm-hmm.
And so there at Ben Hoa, it was sort of a desolate base. All the trees were dead from... we didn't spray them on purpose, but, you know, just the seepage from taking off and landing
mm-hmm.
had killed all the greenery
okay.
around the base.
Okay.
And so I really didn't see much of the country.
Mm-hmm. What did you know of U.S. policy toward Vietnam and the whole Vietnam War? Had you kept up with what was happening overseas and the whole thing?
You mean since...
No, like when you came back from, after Hilo Hattie, you came back into the United States.
Oh.
And did you keep up with what was happening as the war developed?
Of course, only through the TV and mm-hmm. newspapers was my only source of knowledge there.
Mm-hmm.
But...
what did you understand about why the United States was in Vietnam?
Well, to try supposedly to protect democracy in South Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know from what I have read about Vietnam and pictures that they've shown on TV,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes, well... I guess I shouldn't say this, but sometimes I think there are some people that have to be governed with an iron hand.
Okay.
So I don't know, but what they might be better off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I really couldn't say unless I could go back and really visit the country.
Mm-hmm. So you mean now?
Then? Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So tell me what life was like at Ben Hoa for you. What was the base camp like?
It was sort of miserable. Living conditions were not the best in the world at all. We,
mm-hmm.
they were old French type barracks like.
Mm-hmm.
The guys in the hooch that I was living in, we finally managed to salvage, the styrofoam that bombs and things are shipped in.
Mm-hmm.
And that way we were able to seal the walls up with,
mm-hmm.
because the French, they just had sort of like a lattice thing for ventilation all the way around.
Okay.
But we managed to get these places sealed up and
mm-hmm.
got us an air window air conditioner installed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was all just one open bay mm-hmm. barrel. refrigerator, and usually beer was about the only liquid substance we had. The water, it was sort of blackish looking.
You didn't have any purified water brought in for you?
Well, they purified it, supposedly.
Oh, but it was still like
they had a big tank there, a huge tank, but when you opened the spigots, it was, to look at it, you just didn't feel like consuming it.
Okay.
And, of course, the food was not the best in the world.
Mm-hmm. How many men did you live with in this... in your barracks there?
In the barracks, let's see. I guess there was... There must have been about 10 of us,
okay.
I would say,
okay.
Around 10.
Okay. And your mission was under Operation Ranch Hand, is that correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
You were flying spraying Agent Orange.
Right.
And your notes say that you flew 59 combat missions doing this. Describe a typical mission.
Okay, well, we'd be getting up before daybreak.
Mm-hmm.
We'd rush over and try to grab some breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go down to our ops office where we'd be briefed on what area we were to go to and spray.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would don all our paraphernalia, which include a real heavy flight. Both supposed to have been bulletproof vest. It was real thick, something sort of like heavy fiberglass or something. I don't know what the material was.
Mm-hmm.
And our helmets, and we all carried a sidearm and a carbine.
Okay, the M1?
M1, yeah.
Okay.
And,
did you have any protective gear to wear for the Agent Orange?
No.
Okay.
No, they claim that it wouldn't hurt us.
Okay. All right, so you would get briefed on where you would have to go. You'd get dressed up, and then what would happen?
Then we'd go to our assigned aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And start warming up the engines. Usually it'd be anywhere from about 6 to maybe 15 airplanes,
okay.
Depending on the area that was to be sprayed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when we spraying the jungle like that, we would actually have to spray it about 3 different times.
Okay.
The first time, you'd just get the top canopy.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd have to wait about maybe 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
Go back, spray that area again, and then get the second canopy.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 3 to 4 weeks later, then you'd go back, spray it again, and then you get the lower canopy.
Okay. How high did you fly?
Right at treetop level.
Huh. Okay.
Or you might say about 100 feet,
mm-hmm.
above the trees.
So you would fly out. How long did your missions typically last?
Well, it would be depending on which area of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
we were flying. Sometimes it might take us maybe just 30 minutes to get to one area, and then again it might take a little over an hour,
mm-hmm.
to get to an area.
And how long would it take you to do the actual spraying?
Oh, it would only take... It didn't take too long. I'd say about, of course, it seemed a lot longer. But the actual spray run would probably only be maybe 5 minutes at
okay.
the most, probably.
So, did you ever take any fire?
Oh,
fire?
Yes. You were always getting a small arms fire.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, the first mission I went on, I had an engine shot out on my first mission.
Oh, wow. Were you the pilot?
Yes.
Okay.
And
Did they tell you exactly why you were spraying the Agent Orange?
Oh, yeah, to open, supposedly to open up the jungle so we could, they could find the enemy.
Okay.
But in actuality, I think we did the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese a big service by opening it up where they could see to travel.
Okay. Did you ever fly any missions into Laos or Cambodia that you're aware of?
No.
Okay. Okay. And what did they tell you exactly about Agent Orange?
Oh, that, well, they just told us, you know, that it would kill the plants, mm-hmm. things like that, that it wouldn't hurt us or anything, mm-hmm. which was not true.
Right. Did you ever have any direct contact with the defoliant?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the fuselage, see, we had a 1,000-gallon tank mm-hmm. in the fuselage, mm-hmm. and, of course, loading that stuff and everything, it would be spilled all over the fuselage floor.
Hmm.
So your boots and everything were covered in it. Then when you were spraying, mm-hmm. we always had the our side windows open.
Mm-hmm.
So you're flying in formation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably getting a mist from the planes, you know, ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
But I myself, I haven't had any ill effects myself that I know of now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my youngest daughter was conceived right after I came back from Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and she did have some problems, or has some problems.
Really?
The skin pigmentation in her legs and abdomen has all these white streaks, and there's never been any case like that in my family or my wife's family.
Okay. Have you taken, I guess you obviously have checked in with doctors, and have they been able to determine that it was exposure or some kind of Agent Orange related illness?
No. The Air Force in 19, I believe it was 1968, started checking all the pilots, crew members of Ranch Hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time they checked us, they had us to come down to Houston, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And after the checkup, when I got home, I wrote a letter to the Surgeon General and told him, I said, if you want a correlation, I said, you need, the best thing would be to check my two daughters. I said the oldest one was conceived in, before I went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
My second one, which has the problem, was conceived right after I came back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about a month later, got a letter from a phone call from a lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
and said they had received my letter and appreciated it, said, but they had all the medical records.
they didn't want to investigate
admit in it, no. And since Houston, they've been checking us every 5 years out at the La Jolla, California, at the Scripps Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt like it was just a whitewash job. The government can't afford to admit that.
Mm-hmm. Financially, you mean?
Financially, mm-hmm. right. Because it would just involve too much money. You consider all the Americans that were exposed to it,
mm-hmm.
not only the ranch hand crews, but the ground crews mm-hmm. that were in the areas, that happened to be in some of the areas where we sprayed,
mm-hmm.
and the Australians, the Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of Vietnamese that are deformed.
When did you arrive in 1968?
When did I arrive?
Yes, sir.
Let me check here. I don't think I have it.
I was wondering if it was before or after Tet.
Oh, it was before Tet, because I was there doing Tet.
Okay. Can you describe that experience?
Well, they hit Benoit, but we had taken our planes and flown them over to that place on the coast.
Cameron,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And right after everything was over, then we came back.
And did you know? Did someone know that Tet was going to happen? Is
yeah.
That why you got the planes out?
Right.
Huh. Okay.
In fact, say like the hooch we lived in.
Mm-hmm.
The back side was only about 3 feet
mm-hmm.
from the fence line separating us from Vietnamese territory.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't get hold of any Constantino wire
mm-hmm.
to put around there. Well, fortunately, one day I happened to run into an old Army sergeant,
mm-hmm.
and we were talking, and I said, man, I'd give a case of scotch if I could just get hold of some Constantino wire.
Mm-hmm.
He says, where do you want it? About 2 days later, this big semi-truck, Army truck, pulls up with a truckload of Constantino wire.
Mm-hmm.
And they unload it for us. Well, I guess the base commander or somebody called a squadron commander, and he calls me, where did you get that Constantino wire? I said, sir, don't ask.
Did you have to give up the case of scotch?
Yeah, I was glad to give it to him. But Benoit caught it pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they killed an awful lot of Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
There, I have some pictures that one of the base photographers gave me
mm-hmm.
of some dead Viet Cong all lined up. But
what kind of fighting did you experience that night?
Well, see, we went over to Cameron Bay with the planes.
Okay.
So we didn't experience it.
Okay.
Now, backing up some, they used to lob mortars in on us
mm-hmm.
periodically.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, well, we'd jump up and run over to a bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the bunkers, a mortar actually went in and exploded. After that happened, I said, well, to heck with it. When they'd give the warning or we'd hear them coming in, I'd just grab my mattress and roll over on the floor and put the mattress over the top of me. Well, I was just about as safe there as anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you ever experience rocket attacks?
No.
Okay. Okay. What did you guys do for entertainment on the base there?
Just going up to the club and living it up there. That was about the only entertainment we had.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of the donut dollies that were there, the Red Cross girls?
No.
Okay. Okay.
I never saw a Red Cross in action. In our area, they might have been, you know, in some other area. But
mm-hmm. how much were you able to keep up with what was going on at home while you were there for this year?
Well, just through the Stars and Stripes
mm-hmm.
Newspaper and, you know, the radio, mm-hmm. that was about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And did you have regular contact with your family?
Yeah, of course, when I went to Benoit, I had gotten married while I was at Randolph.
Okay.
And my wife and I, we used to mail tapes back and forth
mm-hmm.
to each other. And
mm-hmm. Okay. Did you ever have any exposure or experience with the USO shows?
No.
Okay. How about R&Rs?
Yeah, I took an R&R up to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was up there for about a week.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was that the only one you were able to take?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have a good week up there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
How did it affect you when you got back to Vietnam? Was it very helpful to go to get out of the country for a week?
Oh, yeah. It was real good to get away from there.
Uh-huh.
Get into civilization for a while and have some good food, entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How much drug use did you see there?
Actually, I myself didn't see any.
Okay.
I assume that it was some of them were probably using it, but
mm-hmm.
I myself didn't see any effects of it.
So mainly it was just alcohol drinking?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you ever experience any racial issues there on base?
No. No, I didn't.
Okay. Did you guys have any pets while you were there?
No. I didn't see any pets around our area.
Uh-huh. Okay. Did you ever have any contact with Arvin or any of the indigenous forces?
not while I was at Benoit. Well, of course, our maids.
Mm-hmm.
We had a maid that did some of our laundry and sort of cleaned the hooch.
Mm-hmm. Did you have? Did you get to know her at all, or
just casual?
Uh huh.
Yeah.
What did you think of the Vietnamese civilians while you were back there in 1968?
Well, I really didn't come in contact mm-hmm. with hardly any of them.
Okay. Except just for the cleaning people and
yeah.
maids and what?
Right.
Okay. All right.
And, you know, at the officers' club, they had Vietnamese working in there. But
mm-hmm. Did you ever receive any other training while you were there on the ground in Vietnam?
No.
Okay. And what do you think about everybody had basically a year tour of duty, and there's been some criticism of this after the war about that, you know, it's very, very different from World War II, where people serve until the end of the war. Do you think that would have been doable in Vietnam if you were stationed there just for the entire war?
I don't think so. Now, I guess in the Air Force, it could have been bearable.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel for these Army fellows and Marines that were out on these outposts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe they could have held up, you know, for too long of a period. I think they really had it rough.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have contact with them while you were there?
No.
Okay. Just basically what you've heard since you left.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And when did you leave, actually? You got your orders, I guess. Your year was up, and...
Yeah, I came back in 1969.
Okay.
And, I had been, well, as I told you before, at Randolph, I was in the Special Air Mission Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And there were four of these squadrons that supported the four different Army regions. And we would carry, you know, the commanding generals, and then other dignitaries that the Department of Defense would have us pick up different places, fly places. So I knew I was coming up pretty soon for retirement, and I was trying to get in the squadron in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
Georgia,
mm-hmm.
Dobbins.
Mm-hmm.
But instead they sent me to TAC headquarters at Langley
mm-hmm.
and made me chief of the four SAM squadrons,
okay.
And which was okay with me.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of an awkward assignment because I was just a major.
Right.
And these four squadrons, they had lieutenant colonels for squadron commanders.
Hmm.
Okay. So you're a major, you know, dictating to a lieutenant colonel is a little awkward.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Now, when you left Vietnam, did you fly out on a commercial flight or on a military flight?
It was a commercial charter flight.
Okay. What do you remember about that plane flight when you left and the plane?
Not an awful lot. It was just a real long, tiresome flight.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they'll stop and refuel and change the crew. But you have to stay on board and sit there for the entire flight.
Right. Right. How did you feel leaving Vietnam?
I was glad to leave.
Okay.
In fact, I forget what date I was supposed to leave, but after I had my orders, I'd go down and sit by the terminal in case they had an open seat left, and
mm-hmm.
where I actually got out about 2 days early.
Okay. Looking back at your Vietnam experience, are there any incidents that happened that really stand out in your mind, either while you're on base at Binh Hoa or when you were flying the Ranh An missions?
No. I will say my first mission
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam, mm-hmm. it was enjoyable.
Okay.
Like I said, we weren't supposed to be there. We were living strictly on the economy.
Right.
But it was an enjoyable tour.
Mm-hmm.
And being at Binh Hoa was just one of those unfortunate assignments
mm-hmm.
that you get once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Would you change anything about your Vietnam experience if you could? Like, what would it be?
No, I can't.
Maybe stationed somewhere else.
Yeah, the second tour. I would have preferred to have stayed in the SAM squadron at Tha Chi.
mm-hmm. Right. When you arrived back in the United States, did you have any difficulties at the airports or, you know, your reception back in the United States?
No, I don't know, some people sort of look down on us like, you know, we never should have been there, et cetera, but basically, I guess it was okay.
Okay. How much difficulty, if at all, did you have transitioning back into life here in America when you got back from Vietnam?
I didn't have any problems.
Because you were stayed in the military for a couple more years.
Right.
And you retired in 1971.
Right.
Right, okay. Did you follow U.S. policy after you got back to the United States about what was happening on the ground in Vietnam?
Well, through TV and the newspapers and all, I kept up with it, and I was sorry to see us lose out.
Mm-hmm.
But
go ahead.
No, well, I was through.
Okay. How did you feel about the U.S. policy of turning the war over to the Vietnamese, the Vietnamization policy? Did you think that they could handle the responsibility or the effort to hold up South Vietnam?
No, I didn't feel like they could hold out. And I feel like if Washington, once they had committed the military to fighting
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
if they had only left it up to the field commanders
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam, that we could have probably won.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, any targets you wanted to fire on or bomb or anything, you first had to get permission from Washington.
Right.
And you can't win a war like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, how did you feel in April 1975 when Saigon fell and South Vietnam fell? Do you remember where you were and what you were feeling?
I don't remember just where I was at, but I, you know, what you could see on TV about it and all. I really felt sorry for those Vietnamese that had befriended us because you had no idea what torture they might undergo.
What do you have any thoughts about Vietnam today?
No, not really. It would be interesting if I could go back and just see what it looks like.
Where would you go if you could go back?
Well, I'd like to go back to Saigon and just see what the city looks like now.
Have you been in touch with any Americans or Vietnamese-Americans who made it out of the country and came over here?
No, I haven't.
Okay. When you listen to the radio, do you hear any songs that ever take you back to your time in Vietnam?
No, not really.
Okay. Have you read any good books that you could recommend or you think are pretty accurate portrayals of what happened in Vietnam?
No, I don't think of any. I really haven't read any big books on the action. Of course, you know, in Newsweek, U.S. World News, and all that. I've read a lot of articles in those, but that's about the extent of it.
Okay. Have you seen any movies on Vietnam?
Only on TV.
We
don't even have a theater here.
Okay.
And the nearest theater is more than 20 miles away.
Okay. So when you see it on TV, what are your feelings and thoughts on the war? This much time removed from the war.
I don't know. If it shows some shots maybe around Saigon, it really gets my attention, trying to recognize some of the places, but I can't say that I have any too much, you know, feelings for either way.
What would you say was the most significant thing that you learned from your service in Vietnam? Both tours included.
Oh, gosh.
Not to drink Thuy Hoa beer?
You're right.
No, seriously, what?
Well, I know one day at the races we had a winning ticket, but we had thrown the ticket away before we realized it was a winning ticket. But I really can't think of anything offhand.
Okay. Do you think the United States learned any lessons from the Vietnam War?
I sure hope they have. I don't know whether you heard that racket going by or not.
Yes, sir.
Some guy on a motorcycle racing up and down the street here.
Okay.
What was your question?
Well, what lessons have the United States learned from the Vietnam War, do you think?
Well, I hope they've learned that you can't win a war if you have to depend on getting everything okay through Washington first. I think that was more or less proven in Desert Storm. They gave General Schwarzkopf the go-ahead and left him alone. And you see what a wonderful and fast job he did. Unfortunately, if we go back into there, I'm afraid it's going to be devastating. too many years to build up in anticipation of this.
If you were to tell young people today about the Vietnam War and about your experiences, what would you tell them about Vietnam?
Well, about the only thing I could tell them would be that they're fairly friendly people, and it is a beautiful country. Of course, it's been torn up a lot, but I think at one time it was referred to as the Pearl of the Orient, or the something like that. I forget the correct wording. But that's about all I could say for it. They're industrious.
Okay. Have you ever been to Washington, D.C. and to the Vietnam War Memorial?
No, I haven't.
Would you like to go someday?
Yeah. I think it would be real interesting to see it. Offhand, I really don't know of any friend that was killed there. But I would like to see the wall.
Okay. You said that every 5 years the government's been flying you out to La Jolla to get tested.
Right.
Is it that's continuing?
No. This year was the last year.
Okay. Okay. Do you feel like the government is taking care of its Vietnam veterans?
Not really.
How so?
Well, so much of it, you know, they keep denying. Now, I myself, if I get sick, I go to a private doctor.
You don't go to the VA?
No, I don't go to the VA or to a base.
Okay.
And
well, Mr. Harp, is there anything else you'd like to talk about or anything else you'd like to add to this interview?
I can't think of anything now. Maybe when you send me the draft, if I think of anything more, I can maybe add to it. But offhand right now, I don't think of anything.
Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and wrap it up then.
Okay.
And this will end our oral history interview with Mr. David Harp.